Case number 21-5080, Association of American Physicians and Surgeons, Inc., and Katerina Varelli, individually and on behalf of all others similarly situated, appellants, versus Adam Schiff, in his individual capacity and his official capacity as a member of Congress for the 28th Congressional District of California. Mr. Joseph for the appellants, Mr. Tittleman for the appellate.
Counsel for appellants, please proceed.
Lawrence Joseph for the appellants. May it please the court.
May I ask you to raise the dais so that your voice can be heard?
Yes, I had to figure it out.
The courtroom deputy is supposed to explain
it. It is as high.
It is as high as it can go.
It's as high as it can go, you're
okay.
Right. I'll lean forward, perhaps. Lawrence Joseph for the appellants. May it please the court. My conference with opposing counsel was that there was a decision yesterday, a 70-page decision. It appears involving presidential records and committee of Congress.
You mean the decision by this court?
Yes, correct. And I have not, I've read the first page or two on my phone coming in this morning. It seems that it's not relevant. So if anyone on the court believes it is, I'd request a chance to review that before responding. But that involved a committee of Congress tasked with investigating and reporting. This involves an individual member, so I don't think it's relevant. And I just wanted to say that I had not had a chance to read that.
I haven't either. Does it even relate to speech and debate or a standing?
Well, it relates in part, I suppose, to the power of a committee of Congress and the implied investigative powers. I honestly don't know, Your Honor, if there's anything in there that's relevant.
I don't think so.
Okay, great. Wonderful. What this case does relate to, and it was dismissed on immunity and Article III standing grounds, is the extent to which an individual member of Congress outside the committee structure can interfere with rights of private parties interacting with third parties. The three sort of important things at issue here are standing, immunity, which has two components, the speech or debate clause and also the Federal Tort Claims Act. And then the third important issue is the power that the district court for this district was given in 1801, drawing on the common law of England, or Maryland, I should say, as it existed, which was then pretty much close to the common law of England. And that continued going forward. So there's a
counsel. I advise you to start with the standing issue and the speech and debate, because those are the most important questions you're facing.
They are, but I believe the third also relates to standing, relates to immunity, because the shortly before the founding of this nation, and therefore before Maryland came into existence, and this common law power was given to the district court here in 1801, a colonial governor of the crown was held liable for a tort, malicious prosecution, assault, false imprisonment. And that was done through the common law court, the highest common law court in England, the King's Bench. And that same power was given to the Maryland state court system, which was given to the D.C. court system.
Mr. Joseph, can you cite any case since 1970s Reorganization Act in which the district court has used this historical common law power?
Well,
so that's almost 50 years, more than 50 years.
Well, the Gaiman, Heckler versus Gannon refers to mandamus, and it cites this particular common.
All district courts have mandamus.
Oh, no, the Gaiman court distinguishes the 1361 mandamus, the venue of mandamus act from, if you go back and look at Gaiman, and we cite this.
Is your serious argument that Article 3 is not the limitation on the federal district court in this circuit?
The district court has the power to create a tort against an officer of the national government.
That may or may not be true, but are you suggesting that the district court is like the Supreme Court of Massachusetts? It's not bound by Article 3?
It has the power to create torts. It's, of course, bound by Article III standing, yes.
Yes, so why don't we go to the standing and speech and debate? Because we don't have to even, if you lose on those, we don't even have to get to it.
Well, they do animate the standing inquiry because for several reasons. One is if a tort were created for just this kind of interference, certainly there are concrete things, information,
you
revenue.
You still have to have injury in fact.
That's the third time you've been asked to address standing. Why don't you?
Thank you, Your Honor. So the concrete injuries here are loss of revenue, loss of information, inability to associate, reputational injury, contracts that were modified. Those are all concrete.
Loss of what?
Loss of
income?
Yes, we've mentioned that, yes.
How much?
That was not quantified.
We have no idea whether that's a penny or more. What's your second loss?
We're being branded as anti-vax in this instance.
Who's branding you?
Both the defendant and, I suppose, also the third-party tech companies.
Did he brand you as such?
In his inquiries to the tech companies and in the background negotiations that happened before those were released.
His inquiries to the tech companies do not even mention you or your organization.
That's correct.
So that doesn't work for you. Background? Counsel, let's be clear. What's the background discussion by the chairman?
I'm sorry, could you
repeat that?
I didn't hear you.
What is the background discussion by the chairman on which you are relying?
The chairman
has been branded as anti-vax.
The interaction between the congressman's office and the companies with which he was.
What specifically, counsel? I didn't see anything in your brief. He's inquiring of these companies. He doesn't mention you or your operation or anything.
The allegation in the complaint is that they worked behind the scenes to develop a position, and then they issued this press release announcing the
that's going to causation. Let's assume arguendo for purposes of discussion, because you have injury in fact if your voice is muted, if your ability to speak is somewhat diminished. That could be injury in fact, but I don't see for the life of me how you get causation.
Well, again, we would be willing to bring in the third party companies as defendants.
Well, No. Your case is before us now. What is your theory of causation?
That this was the intended result of negotiation.
What was?
The elimination that the deplatforming of, so there are these search engines that used to develop a reliable stream of traffic to our sites. Google is one of the bigger ones. DuckDuckGo, I think, is one of the smaller ones.
So the social media cut you down, right?
That's right.
But what's the causation?
The causation is...
Well, that may be the injury. In fact, where's your causation?
The negotiation between the congressman's office and the tech companies.
The congressman never even mentioned the tech company.
He did communicate with the tech company.
He never mentioned you.
Yeah, well, we are. So we're not alleging, I guess, defamation in that he said.
No, there's no connecting link.
Well, the connecting link is down. We have what the complaint alleges is good information presenting all sides of a debate on vaccines. anything that questions the dominant narrative from Representative Schiff is considered anti-vax information, and you can't listen to that. So we weren't the intended
you have a
victim.
Third party who arguably caused you injury, but there is no connection to the defendant.
The defendant sent his letters. We say they negotiated beforehand before they were released, and then immediately thereafter we had a plummet. I think that there's enough there for Article III standing and causation and.
And how about redressability?
Well, redressability, if there's two things, I suppose. One, we could get damages. That's a possibility. It gets to the immunity question, which we haven't discussed yet. Two,
damages for what particularly?
Abusive process interference with, constitutional
process law. Interference with what?
With First Amendment rights. So, trying to retrace my thoughts. So the immunity thing.
In other words, anytime a member of Congress writes a private entity about a particular subject of interest to your association, that's enough for Article III standing?
Well, this was a little bit of an extreme example that the answer to your question may be yes or no, but here what we have is very targeted to deplatform. So it's not just writing a letter. The goal is to sort of shut down information of a disfavored variety. And yes, the fact that he's a federal actor makes that problematic, whereas if they were just private actors conspiring, that would be a different thing.
So you would just cut back on Congress's ability to inquire. And we haven't gotten to speech or debate yet, but you're just saying he's just a single congressman, although you sued him as chairman, right?
No.
You sued him individually?
Yes.
You're seeking damages against him individually?
Sorry, let me clarify. We sued him, we didn't sue him in his capacity as chairman of the Intelligence Committee. We sued him in his official and individual capacity. His official is as a member of Congress. That, you know, if you want to infer into that.
But you're going after him as an individual as well?
We named him individually as well. And for abusive process, if indeed that's what he did, he is not Congress. He's referred to him several times, Your Honor, as Congress. He is one member of one body of the House. I'm sorry, one member of one body of Congress, the House. He is not. He does have an interest, I suppose, as indicated by prior years in which he got issued an identical.
Back to Judge Silverman's question, redressability.
So damages or an injunction that would take away, again, he's publishing on social media, which under Proxmire and McSherley, he's outside of the realm of Congress.
Let me stop you for that a moment on that. You do mention letters he sent from Congress. But that has nothing to do with your gravamen of your case. Your gravamen of your case, I gather, is that the defendant, by sending letters to social media, implicitly threatened them. Isn't that correct?
In truth, I suppose we don't know if they were willing co-conspirers or whether he coerced them in a threatening way and made them do it.
I understood your complaint was that there was a threat, an implicit threat.
We allege that he coerced them into this,
okay.
Yes.
So the outside communication has nothing to do with your case.
the publication on social media by the congressman. So I'm sorry, social media comes into play here in two ways.
No, I know how social media comes into play. That's your third party factor. But you're absolutely right about the Proxmire case indicating that communications outside Congress are not covered by speech and debate. And you do have communications, but they're not relevant to your gravamen of your suit, which is the threat.
Well, that's, but he also goes on social media and brags about this. So this is essentially posturing. I mean, again, the way this
bragging about it is not part of your loss and not part of your injury. Your injury is that you were kicked off the social media.
And branded, I mean, to the extent that reputational injury is part of it, the broad brush of calling.
Because of being kicked off social media, you're hurt.
Okay.
That's your injury.
There's a reputational injury, but yes, that's the primary one.
Okay. So all I'm trying to say is the outside communication is not really relevant to the key of your lawsuit, which is the threat, the alleged threat that his communication with social media creates.
Well, I would disagree, because if a body of Congress wants to enact a law about some thing, sort of behavior being inappropriate, they can do that and it has to get signed by the president or overridden.
No,
but this is just one member of Congress saying bad things about something and then going online in his social media accounts afterwards and saying bad things about a particular line of thought, and that line of thought then being beaten down, suppressed from the public debate.
Is your case a defamation case?
No, there's a defamation injury, and we wanted to be. He's put his.
Wait a minute, I didn't see that in your complaint.
There's a reputational injury that's cited in the complaint. If you want to.
Reputational injury because of being kicked off the social media.
I'm sorry. It's being called anti-vax. The complaint says that means unintelligent or uneducated, and what it really means is someone that disagrees with the representative's narrative on whatever he thinks is right about.
The facts of your case were as follows. You put things on social media, and your statements are, we have questions about these vaccines, but on the one hand, there's this view, on the other hand, there's that view. And so in your opinion, you're not pro-vax or anti-vax, all right?
Correct.
So, the fact that the congressman writes letters saying to the tech companies, I'm concerned about misinformation appearing, this doesn't have anything to do with you.
But it resulted
in my hypothetical.
I'm sorry.
Now you say, well, if we say to the congressman, you're liable in damages. And suppose he pays the money. How does that stop Google, everybody else, where you made money before, from keeping you off?
Well, that is a form of redress if the question is Article III standing.
But
the
you're
other,
trying to, you base your injury on what happened as a result of these letters, where the letters said nothing about you in terms of your association.
Right.
All right? All I'm getting at is, how is your injury redressed by making a member of Congress pay damages? Because the people or the entities you want to carry your message have decided they're not going to carry it anymore for whatever reason. They had a change in the board of directors. They had a change in policy. They're just not going to carry your messages anymore.
The other, and this goes back to Judge Silverman's question about redressability. I said there were two. I mentioned damages. We went off on the recent discussion. The other is that we could get his his statements outside of Congress, so his social media statements, taken down. That's a form of equitable relief. Doesn't even implicate the Federal Tort Claims Act. That would leave us free, as far as standing and first-party injury are concerned, that would leave us free to negotiate with the Googles of the world. You may express...
So let me understand. What would the court order say about his outside statements?
You said the four corners?
No, the court
order. I said...
Judge Rogers asked, what did the court below say about that?
The court below, I don't believe, addressed, I may be wrong here, I don't recall how the court addressed the idea that there's a first-party injury by virtue of interacting with the vendor-vendee relationship, and just the redressability would exist under...
I think the question is, what would our court order say?
Well, it would say, so it would say that this is improper meddling, Representative.
Improper meddling? What is? Asking questions of tech companies?
Well, you're taking the surface of what's available.
I'm just asking you, counsel. It's not a letter that says, take down this website, all right? It says, I'm concerned about misinformation being... sent out, and the tech companies said, we're not doing that, you know, end of discussion. Or the tech company could say, we're not going to carry certain websites in the future. And what does our order say to be sure that your website is not taken down?
Well, the availability of declaratory relief or injunctive relief about the inappropriateness of to the extent that we can prove that Representative Schiff worked behind the scenes, and this wasn't really honest fact-finding, which is what we allege. We allege it was kabuki theater. He arranged the result with them, then sent a letter, and then, hey, presto, they did a press release, and then
in a complaint, you are saying to the court, you can prove this. And you've made allegations, but now on the motion to dismiss, what did you say in response?
I don't believe that this issue came up particularly. It was, I think we were given short shrift, and I think the court is supposed to assume the truth of our allegations, and didn't in this respect. But again, so if we remove the thumb on the scale that we say Representative Schiff is trying to put, then we'd be free to win or lose, and that's FEC versus Aikens, in our negotiations without the impermissible federal interference.
Mr. Joseph, I mean, members of Congress frequently make speeches or send letters on all number of topics which may affect private behavior, which then may have an effect on a third-party organization. Are you aware of any case in which a court has found that to be an injury for the third party, where a member of Congress's actions have, you know, created an impact that had an effect on a third party? I mean, because this is happening every day, right, where members of Congress are speaking out on various...
Well, topics. It shouldn't be in this sense. This is someone basically as a lone wolf...
Counsel, isn't your best answer the Proxmire case?
Well, there's the Proxmire case. There's also Block versus Meese, which was the Department of Justice, but it wasn't a member of Congress. But they were labeling someone as propaganda. Here, we're being labeled as anti-vax and idiots and anti-science, which is odd because my clients are the scientists, not the representative.
I understand that, and I understand the political harm that you are alleging, but in what way is it an Article III type of injury?
In the same way in Blanc versus Meese. I mean, in other words, if you're in Blanc versus Meese, the label was propaganda, and if you were associated with the propaganda, you were a bad person. And the court, this court, distinguished between legal causation and de facto causation. Legal causation went to whether you could prove damages or not. All you needed for standing was de facto causation, which is if people incorrectly believe that the DOJ tried to argue, but propaganda doesn't mean what they're saying it means, but people are taking it that way. And here, it's even worse because they were still able to reach their customers. It was the 80s. Now, we don't even they have severed the connection between us and the people with whom we were communicating. So we don't even get to the question of whether the consumer thinks the anti-vax label is improper and therefore they should dissociate with us. That was the issue in Block versus Meese.
But I'm still trying to figure out why the community, I grant you under Proxmire, the Supreme Court said communications directed outside of Congress may not be covered by speech and debate. But I still don't see why that is relevant to your basic gravamen of your case, which is an implicit threat that Congress makes, and thereby the social media kick you off. So the communication outside doesn't seem to have particular relevance. You're upset about being kicked off.
Well, I mean, to some extent, your question recalls Franklin versus Massachusetts, I might have the order wrong, but the idea there was how is this, I can't order the president to do something, but just a court ruling saying what the law is would be meaningful. In other words, saying you can't do this under the First Amendment, that would stop.
I was just dealing with your communication outside.
Right, and if that's impermissible,
but
then we can strike
that's
it.
That's particularly relevant to your case.
Well, again,
you're not making a defamation argument, as was true in Proxmire.
Right. That's true. We're not making a defamation argument.
So
we're saying that
your basic argument, I understand it, is there was an implicit threat when the congressman sent a letter out and the third party reacted to that implicit threat. That's your allegation. Isn't
that is one half of it. The other side of that coin is that they're working together to suppress speech.
Come on. That's the legal conclusion. I'm talking about the facts of your allegation. I understand your allegation. All I'm trying to say, it doesn't seem to have anything to do with public statements. It has to do with pressure on the social media companies.
That is a component, and then he's gloating about it afterwards. And
whether he's gloating or not, that's not relevant. Your only concern is that he allegedly knocked you off social media.
Okay. But the question is the extent to which judicial power can touch what he's doing, either before or after, under the.
Well, there's several problems. The first of which, there is no direct threat against you. Not at all. You're not even mentioned. So causation seems to be very weak. Very weak. There's nothing you allege that leads us to conclude that your allegation is that there was a threat and therefore they folded. You didn't say that?
Well, and then the First Amendment context that we're in, overbreadth is another concern. In other words, if someone's shooting out, normally if they were saying that you were doing something improper or whatever, I won't come up with a colorful example, but that might be defamation. But if what you're doing is saying a whole group of thought is improper for public discourse and shouldn't be online, that is causation.
I don't have any further questions.
Okay, why don't we hear from counsel for appellee?
Good morning, Your Honors. Todd Tattleman for Congressman Schiff. I'm the Principal Deputy General Counsel for the House of Representatives. I want to start, I think, where all three of you already are, Your Honors, which is there's an 800-pound gorilla in the room here. There is an absence of standing here because whatever injuries these plaintiffs may have suffered, and I'm not going to concede that they've suffered any legal injuries.
Well, why wouldn't a diminution in their ability to speak be as much of an injury as turning off the megaphone from somebody speaking in Lincoln Park?
If there were an actual diminution, Judge Silberman, I think you'd be right, but there isn't one here. They haven't alleged one here.
They haven't alleged their voice has been muted?
They've alleged that their internet presence has been diminished, but they're still able to publish.
That's an injury in fact, seems to me, although the district judge didn't think so. But I have more problems with causation and redressability.
I was just about to get there, Your Honor, which is to say, even if you assume that there is an injury in fact, the problem here is that the Mr. Schiff, the congressman, is the wrong party to be the defendant. The proper parties here are the tech companies, the social media companies.
Suppose the letter that Congressman Schiff sent to the social media companies said, I want the defendant off social media, and if you don't accommodate my views, God help you on Section 230.
If that were what a hypothetical letter says, and it's certainly not what the letters Congressman Schiff sent in this case said, but if that were a hypothetical letter sent, then I think I would need to shift my focus and talk to you about the fact that he would still be immune under the speech or debate clause, because that official letter would potentially implicate other things, particularly the legislation necessary to enact changes to Section 230. But right now we're only talking about standing, and under the standing doctrine, as this case has been presented, first of all, there was no...
Well, there would be causation under that my hypothetical, would there not?
I would certainly challenge that there would be causation, yes.
Why? But Why wouldn't you concede there was causation?
I wouldn't concede it, Your Honor. I would suggest that there was still an absence of causation because the tech companies still needed to effectuate that. His injuries, his client's injuries are caused by the tech companies. Their actions are the proximate cause of the injuries, not the letters.
The congressman could, with impunity, threaten the tech companies.
I wouldn't say with impunity, Your Honor. He could certainly make his public policy position well known. He could certainly advocate for a position that says, because you tech companies have failed to do things that I find, or other members like me find unacceptable, we are going to consider legislation that would remedy that. He may do those
things. The question is whether that might still be covered by speech and debate, but wouldn't causation be established?
Again, under your hypothetical, Your Honor, I think that you're assuming that the link follows, that because he makes the threat, the tech companies do what he wants them to do, or they refuse to do it, and Congress passes a change in the law. Either way, I think their causation link is problematic because the independent actor of the tech company still gets to make a decision. Facebook could decide, we're perfectly comfortable leaving these people on our platform, and we're perfectly comfortable with whatever Congress comes up.
Normally, we conclude if somebody puts a gun to the hand of a third party and says, don't do something, causation is established.
Under certain circumstances, I would agree with that, Your Honor. But here, I don't know that that necessarily follows, because these tech companies are motivated by a tremendous number of factors, none of which can be established, in your hypothetical, doesn't necessarily establish that it would be Congressman Schiff's letter or his threat, express or implicit, that would lead them to take the actions that caused the injury. It might, and if it could be established that it did, I would concede that causation was there. But simply on its face, I don't know that that's sufficient, and I would certainly suggest that it isn't.
And would such a letter be covered by the speech and debate immunity?
I would want to see I would want to probe more details into what exactly the letter says. But hypothetically, a letter that suggests that unless a private company does certain things that Congress finds acceptable, Congress is going to consider changes in the law and lays out what those potential changes would be, I would think we could make a very good argument that such a letter could be covered under the speech or debate clause. There's a line there, and it could cross it. But
Congress has the authority to direct private companies to take action?
Not direct.
A single member has the ability to do that?
No, Your Honor, a single member doesn't have the ability to do it, but the single...
But you're saying that would be a legislative activity. Telling a private company what to do would be a legislative activity within the scope of the speech and debate clause?
I'm suggesting that it could be a legislative activity, depending on how it was phrased, depending on the rest of the context.
Directing private companies what to do is a legislative activity?
I don't think it would be directing them, Your Honor. As I understood Judge Silverman's hypothetical, it was a suggestion. It was using the political tools and the leverage that they have to change the law to effectuate a result. Again, I think there is a line there that and this is why I hedged at the beginning, which is there is a line, and I'm willing to concede that. But I don't know that merely suggesting that that a member could suggest to a group of companies like this, that unless you all companies make significant changes to your operations or your behaviors, the Congress is going to consider legislation to make them for you. I do think that potentially would be protected under the speech or debate clause. How you communicate that, the language that gets used, all of those things would come into play in that analysis. But as a hypothetical matter, yes, I think that potentially could be covered.
Could there be constitutional problems that would circumvent the speech and debate clause? Are you familiar with Pillsbury case in the Fifth Circuit?
From the Fifth Circuit, Your Honor, yes, where the members in that case interfered with the decision makers at the regulatory agency.
Right. And that was violation of the Constitution.
That was found to have been a violation of due process for that company.
Yes. I'm glad you are familiar with the case. But would not any threat a congressman issued against speech raise First Amendment questions, just like due process questions?
Yes, it would raise those questions, Your Honor, but the Supreme Court's jurisprudence and this court's jurisprudence, and I would point you to the most recent example being the case Rangel versus Boehner, has said very clearly that the mere allegation that something violates a constitutional right or even a rule of the House isn't enough to get around the speech or debate immunity. So, yes, it would raise the questions, but I still think that the immunity could hold.
Well, under any circumstances, no matter how significant the threat was to stop speaking?
Again, I want to be careful, very careful here, because I don't want to suggest that there are absolutely no circumstances upon which, but I think you have to get very, very far down the line here, and I'm not sure that the hypothetical circumstances that we're talking about get that far down the line. Hypothetically, they could. I think we could come up with potential examples between us that might reach that. This case certainly doesn't come anywhere close to it. So even if there are examples several steps removed from where we are here, this case isn't that case.
I'll just ask you to clarify something on the sovereign immunity point. Is your position that if this is only sovereign immunity that is covered by the Westfall Act? Or are you suggesting there is some broader sovereign immunity that is not statutory? I just want to be clear about that.
We think we've been very clear in our papers that it is the first one, the Westfall Act. Okay. It's the sovereign immunity that has been extended by Congress through the Westfall Act and the amendments to the FTCA in 1988.
So you're not claiming any non-statutory sovereign immunity?
No, Your Honor, not here. I'm happy to answer any other questions, Judge Rogers, if you had any, or anyone else. If not, I think it's very clear the district court's opinion was correct. It should be upheld. The lack of standing and the application of the speech or debate clause to this particular case are more than sufficient to uphold the motion to dismiss. Judge Contreras' opinion is correct as a matter of law, and this court should uphold it.
Thank you, counsel. All right, counsel for appellants.
I regret that we didn't talk about immunity before, because I think it's a little unfair to my colleague to have me say what I'm going to say now, which is all in our briefs. There is no speech or debate.
Previously talk about what?
Immunity. When I was at the podium, we talked about standing. And
so what is your argument?
Essentially, the Westfall Act provides no immunity. It's more of a double negative. What the FTCA does is it waives sovereign immunity for damages. It has nothing to do with injunctive relief. It waives sovereign immunity for damages, but under Passman versus Davis, there is no sovereign immunity for, or rather, there's no common law sovereign immunity for members of Congress outside of the speech or debate clause. So if we're right that this is not within the speech or debate clause, he has no immunity whatsoever. What the Westfall Act does is it says.
I think our questions have tried to make you focus on the allegations in your complaint and what your claimed causation is and how we could redress that.
I think if we're right about immunity, which I didn't discuss before because you didn't ask me about it, if we're right about immunity, then we could perhaps amend the complaint to address standing. So it's, in other words, we lost on two.
Yes, I mean, you can always refile too, but that's not the case that's before us. And suggesting that on reply seems somewhat inappropriate, counsel. Too late.
Well, we have argued throughout in their complaint that if you think we have a redressability problem, we can name the third party companies.
Of course you can. You could have done that in the beginning in the district court and you discussed that. So what else do you have to respond?
Well, there's some argument
before the court.
There's some FTCA case law from before 2016 that suggests that there's immunity here. But Simmons case basically acknowledges that statute, all the exceptions to the FTCA are prefaced by this chapter does not apply to the following exceptions. So if you're in one of those exceptions, and the parties here agree that we are, the discretionary function one here, if you're in one of those exceptions, the entire FTCA, including the Westfall Act, doesn't apply. So the Westfall Act does nothing. Passman versus Davis says that immunity for a member of Congress is limited. There is no sovereign immunity, common law sovereign immunity, like you all, judges and members of the executive branch have. There is none in the executive.
That's the reason I asked.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you, Your Honor. So, again, if you take away this one basis that the district judge thought we were dead, how do we know he wouldn't let us amend? We'd asked in our complaint to let us amend. You know, don't dismiss us unless... don't dismiss us. Let us add the third party companies if that's a problem. We said that we don't want to sue Google if we don't have to. That obviously would entail difficulties for us. But the district judge viewed an immunity problem and a standing problem. We say the standing problem is curable. He's wrong about the immunity problem. Of course, the other side says that he's right about both. And if the other side's correct about that, then there's no point even arguing about standing because there's immunity. But if there's no immunity, I believe we ought to be able to correct. We pled that we wanted to correct if it were necessary. And actually, just if I may, in closing, the Simmons
we
case.
We are clear, though, counsel, after the district court ruled, you never filed a motion to amend your complaint in the district court.
It would have been futile, Your Honor, because of the
second. I asked you yes or no.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm having a little difficulty hearing you. Yes, you are correct.
In the district court. After the district court ruled against you, did you file a motion to reopen, reconsider, and amend your complaint?
Your Honor, no, we did not. And the reason we did not is because it would have been futile. If it were just about standing, we could have. But because of the immunity holding, which we disagree with, we needed to bring it here. And I believe under 28 U.S.C. 1653, we could still, it would be unusual, certainly, we could still in this court today or after I write it, file a motion to amend the complaint. I'm not saying we should do that, but I do think we could cure the standing problem. And if we're right about immunity, we'd have a shot here. We didn't have a shot in district court. And I do encourage you to invite opposing counsel back to discuss the Simmons and the FTCA and the Westfall Act, because I think those are very important issues, separate and apart from this case. Is there nothing further?
My counsel, if my colleagues have no further questions, then thank you, counsel, very much. We'll take the case under advisement.